Vaingra Chaitanya Goswami Vaya Chandra Vinda Bhakti Vedanta Goswami Shiva Prabhupada Ki Sri Sri Gaurinitaya Ki Sri Mayapur Chandrajaya Mandir Ki Sri Granthraj Srimad Bhagavat Mahapurana Ki Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Gaura Premanandi Hari Hari Bol. All glories to the Sam of Devotees. All glories to the Sam of Devotees. All glories to the Sam of Devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga. Glories to Sri Prabhupada. Now he just intelligently turned off the light.
I can get it.
It's on the top in the middle. I think. Because at one point the light has to be turned on. At that point we usually forget. So, thank you again for attending our course on the Bhagavad Science of Mind. And as is our procedure, we're going to start by beginning with any questions that you might have. If anyone has been nursing a question overnight, please don't be shy. Let's hear it and discuss it. Yes?
The word,
Anyonya.
Would you spell it for me, please? And then there were three word-for-word definitions I didn't quite get.
Yes. So, as I said, it's a contraction. Just like we say in English, can't. Instead of saying cannot, you can also say can't. So, in Sanskrit, the full word would be anyaha anya. But it becomes contracted anyonya. A-N-Y-O-N-Y-A. Anyonya. And literally, it means other. But Prabhupada translates it as each other, one another, like that. But it definitely, main thing is it indicates a relationship. Anything else? Yes?
This was two classes before.
Two classes before.
Yes, you mentioned that night we enter into deep sleep, you said, embrace of Brahma. You said that it's Sankarshan.
Yes.
I read a quote of Srila Prabhupada. He said that when we are advanced in Krishna consciousness, every sunrise we experience with the embrace of Krishna. So
That's another thing. Of course, when one is Krishna conscious, then one is, as Prabhupada once said in a lecture a long time ago, one of his earlier lectures, I remember, a Krishna-conscious person will see the same external manifestations of nature as an ordinary person, yet he will not see them in the same way. So, an ordinary person will see a tree, a devotee will see a tree, plus Krishna. The tree will remind him of Krishna. And especially sunrise is, in Vedic culture, very auspicious time. With the rise of the sun, the appearance of the sun, that is the eye of the Lord, that is the appearance of Surya Narayan, because actually there is a sun god. The way it works, as explained in the Shastra, is there are 12 demigods known as Adityas, and they each take turn every month to be the sun god. And they're riding that chariot. And the chariot is carrying the Parashakti, which is actually a very, very effulgent, powerful form of Lakshmi Devi. So she's actually the source, she's actually the effulgence of the sun. So Lakshmi is not the consort of that demigod. Behind Lakshmi, there is Narayan, Surya Narayan. And so he is the real sun, but because he is transcendental, therefore demigod is taking the evidential role of the sun god. But the actual origin of energy of sun is transcendental. Krishna and Krishna's energy. So, a devotee sees this. This is Shastra Shakshush, but more than that, as a devotee advances, it's not simply a matter of, oh, you see something and you remember, oh yes, there's some verse that says some, but it becomes heartfelt, you see. So, especially at this point, feeling the embrace of the Lord when one sees the sunrise, this means he is very Krishna conscious. So that's a natural thing. One will also, like Parasara Muni, who is one of our great authorities actually, he says that the deity, the real deity behind the moon is Krishna. The deity behind the sun is Lord Ram, Ramachandra. Behind the moon is Lord Krishna. So similarly, seeing the full moon at night, especially upcoming Gaurpurnima, we're going to be reminded of Lord Gauranga Mahaprabhu, Lord Krishna. So there's so many ways to see Krishna if one's eyes are spirit. Premanjana Churita Bhakti Vilokchanina. When the eyes are spirit with the salve of love of Krishna, one will see Krishna everywhere. But this phenomena of entering into deep sleep, that happens to everyone, no matter what their consciousness is. You see? Because you actually, if you do not enter that phase of sound sleep, deep, dreamless sleep, for some nights, if your sleeping is disturbed somehow, then it's been shown by modern medical science that this can cause one to go insane. One loses all of one's bearings in the world. And that is because the soul is nourished in that state. He's like, yes, he's held in the embrace of the Lord, and he's actually nourished to be able to face another day battling with the material nature. And if he couldn't do that, he will be very quickly worn out, and his consciousness will more or less disintegrate. See, not hold together. And that's what we call insanity. When insanity is when what you're seeing has nothing to do with what you're hearing. You see? These are crazy people. They're seeing, but then they're hearing something else, some voice, or simply they cannot connect the two because their mind is disintegrated. It's not holding together. And they become totally bewildered. So we actually, even in material consciousness, we, to use that phrase, keep it together by the grace of the Lord in this deep sleep period. We all need that rest. Is there anything else? Any other question? Yes.
You explained that the different aspects of the mind, thinking, feeling and learning, are connected to the yoga processes, and that feeling is connected to bhakti yoga. Mm. So, but then you said, if we want to become Krishna conscious, then we have to change our desiring. Mm. So it sounds a little bit like karma yoga then. How can one
I hate to sound like I'm sidestepping your question, but we will go very deeply into that in a later chapter when we talk about Ramanuja's system of psychology. So he covers that very extensively. So, actually, my even mentioning that was sort of out of place, but sometimes I like to give just a little crumb of what is to come, you know, to whet the appetite. But right now is not the time to talk about that. We'll get to that. And I'm sure you'll be very satisfied. Anything else? Yes?
This question was covered in the first introductory classes, but in the Bhagavatam, it talks about how the mind is connected with the mode of goodness.
Yes.
And the intelligence is connected with the mode of passion.
Yes.
in the Bhagavad Gita, those elements are listed in what seems to be from a more gross to more subtle. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be reversed in the Bhagavad Gita, where they mention mind versus flesh plus ego.
Yes.
I'm wondering if what that is all about.
Well, then we have to talk about the context. There's a very... I highly recommend a book. I don't know how widely read it is among devotees, but it is a book that was originally written by Srila Prabhupada as 5 articles in Bengali, which has been translated and published in one volume called Renunciation Through Wisdom. And when we at this school, I've been speaking with Bhaktivedanta Puna Maharaj lately, we have to revive our Bhakti Shastri course. We've kind of put the, as they say, the cart before the horse. We have a nice Bhagavatam class, which is for Bhakti by Bhav and Bhakti Vedanta, but we don't have a Bhakti Shastri course here. So I want to include this book, Renunciation Through Wisdom, into the study of Bhagavad Gita, because this is, Prabhupada wrote this in the late 40s, early 50s, and is a very profound study into deep look into the Gita. And so one of the points that comes clear in Renunciation Through Wisdom is that the Bhagavad Gita, of course it is a bhakti shastra, and what I'm about to say is not in any, because I'm just citing Srila Prabhupada, so it's not intended to confuse you or throw you off the track. But Prabhupada consistently maintains that the message of Bhagavad Gita is buddhi yoga. So now, this means you start with the buddhi, but you're engaging it in service to the Lord. And then he says, buddhi yoga can take, according to the desires of the living entity, it can take 3 forms. Buddhi yoga can manifest as karma yoga, but that means the karma yoga, the type of karma yoga that one title in Gita, action in Krishna consciousness, you see, it's called sakam karma yoga. The person has desires, like for example, I don't want to sound pejorative, but the independent householder, you know? I mean, by that I just simply mean that householder, he's living a decent life as a devotee with his family, but they live outside. They have some type of job or business or whatever it is, their own economic support. But they're Krishna conscious, they have temple at home. But sometimes, you know, there's that category, independent. And I don't mean that in any bad way. You know, sometimes he's too independent. I like people who are independent myself. I'm extremely independent. So this is a person who, he's in that position because he has some desires of his own that are not going to, if he would just move into the temple, then these desires would be left to, you know, dangle out and be captured by the material energy and give him trouble. So better he maintains his own. Prabhupada did that. See, Prabhupada was always thought of by his godbrothers as kacha grihastha, which means kacha is a Bengali term for, you know, not so first class. No. Paka means first class, you know. That's brahmachari sannyasa. Kacha means... they used to refer to him like that. See? But he's a devotee, that's the point. He has some perhaps independent desires that are a little independent of the program of the temple, but he's a devotee. So Prabhupada said this is buddhi yoga, because he's following Bhagavad Gita, he's engaging in devotional service as per Bhagavad Gita, but karma yoga is prominent in his devotional service. And then there's the jnana yogi, we should say jnana mishra bhakti. So this person also is not, you won't see him so much out on the street distributing books and frontline preaching. He more likes to read and study and write and contemplate. So that's another kind of desire, more subtle type of book. So this is also perfectly engageable in this process called Buddhi Yoga, the yoga of intelligence. And then Prabhupada goes on to say, and when Buddhi Yoga reaches its own perfection, then it is known as Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga is a stage where... It always surprises me. They never think. Anyway, Bhakti Yoga is the stage where the devotee sincerely from within the heart only wants to do what Krishna wants. You see, he wants to serve Krishna's mission. Krishna has a mission in this world. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come to spread the Sankirtan movement to every town and village. And that's all this devotee wants to do. So when Buddhi Yoga reaches that stage where all other desires become unimportant, all right, I've lived outside enough, I've studied enough, I know the philosophy, now it's time for me just to get into, just throw myself into the preaching mission. And he can do that enthusiastically and maintain himself by that. So then that's when Buddhi Yoga reaches its maturity. So you have to see things in that context. So Buddhi, yes, that type of Buddhi which is superior to the mind, which is, as Prabhupada said, right next to the soul, is the Buddhi which is coming from Krishna, which we're receiving through Bhagavad Gita, through Guru Shastra Sadhu. But in the material creation, the Buddhi which arises from the Raju Guna, and here's another important point. Very often you'll find that Srila Prabhupada, when he talks about the mind, his definition of the mind includes ahamkara and buddhi. He talks about the mind as a general thing, the subtle body. So, and that's a fact. In my preparation for this, I have also consulted Pancharatrik scriptures. I have mainly stuck to Srila Prabhupada's books in my presentation, but I've done a lot of other research, and so I understood from what Prabhupada wrote that the mind is really one, there's one subtle body. It's not like there's three separate things, false ego, intelligence, and mind. These are three separate, but actually there's one linga sharira, it's called, one subtle body. And intelligence and false ego are functions within the subtle body. And these functions are determined by the modes of they're effects of the modes of nature. So when the subtle body is agitated by the mode of passion, then it acts in this way we call material buddhi, material intelligence, which is what you need to use your senses. So an ordinary materialistic person, you know, he doesn't have any spiritual interest at all. He hasn't, you know, no interest in religion, God, philosophy. But he can be very expert at doing something with his hands. You know, he could be an expert carpenter, or guitar player, or artist, a good painter. So that's intelligence. But that's intelligence in the mode of passion, you see. And so, in the scheme of creation, just when the Lord is releasing the living entities to the fate of their karmas that they have accumulated from previous cosmic manifestations that are waiting in the form of bodies that they're going to take. So he's giving them buddhi according to those bodies, you see. So the there's a species of termites, for example. I think they're in Africa. And they build these high-rise apartment buildings out of the desert earth. And they build them according to the movement of the sun, so that in the day, it's like the top, only the top, it's in line with the sun. So the hot sun rays are coming down, straight down on the top. It's like a long, narrow structure. So mostly through the day it's cool because the wind is blowing, wind will blow from the side, you see. So the sun is coming down from the top and the wind is blowing from the side and sort of blowing the heat away. So air conditioning. It's an air conditioned termite nest. But because the sun has been beating down on the top all day, then the earth does absorb the heat, so that at night in the desert it becomes bitterly cold. Then the termite high-rise is heated also, because the earth retains the heat. So these termites, they have this booty coming from the Lord, how to build very nice, naturally heated at night and air-conditioned in the day, high-rise apartment structures for them, you see. It's just naturally invested in that body. So Prabhupada said every living entity has its particular intelligence and particular, even mystic power, like Prabhupada. Common thing is these plants. Prabhupada said they eat through their feet, through the roots. We can't do that, but they can. Or birds can fly. We can't fly, but birds can fly. So this is also an aspect of buddhi, because the mystic yogis, they're using buddhi too, to connect not exactly with Paramatma himself, but Paramatma in the heart is also surrounded by his mystic powers by which he creates, maintains, and annihilates the universe. These astasiddhis are associates of Paramatma. So those siddha yogis who want these powers, they come just to the point of Paramatma realization, but it's more or less like hello, goodbye. So like, hello Paramatma, thanks for the powers, see you later. And then they go back to the material world and, you know, become mystics who cheat other people. So my point is that the buddhi that is given to us just as part of the creative function, that is in the mode of passion. And the mind is in the mode of goodness. See, the mind is then, in this sense, more sensitive than that buddhi. That buddhi, that passionate buddhi, is just there for manipulation. It's just for becoming a skillful manipulator of material nature. You see? And even ruthless, you know, like business people. They certainly have intelligence. You know, for cutthroat business tactics, stab in the back tactics, you know. Shaking the hands as if they're friends and then cheating their friend as soon as they can. Ruthlessly. So this is a kind of buddhi too. So Bhagavad Gita, you have to understand the context. Bhagavad Gita is about buddhi yoga. You take that buddhi and engage it in the service of the Lord. Instead of serving your desires with your intelligence, you serve the Lord's instructions. And the Lord begins to instruct. This is how Bhagavad Gita is constructed. So he begins distinguishing. You see, buddhi begins with prajna. That's in the second chapter, prajna. The clear understanding, I am not the body. I'm spirit soul. So then, if I'm not the body, I'm spirit soul, but still I have the body, then what is my duty? So then Krishna starts to talk in chapter 3 about karma yoga. And then in the fourth chapter, he adds knowledge to it. And then in the fifth chapter, it becomes karma yoga action in Krishna consciousness. You see? First, karma yoga means it's a regulation of your activities according to the Vedas. But you don't necessarily know why you're doing it, but you're pious enough that you want to do it. You're afraid of, I think many devotees know this quotation of Srila Prabhupada. He once said that the problem with my Western disciples is that they're not afraid of Maya. Because in the West we have, you know, this was a new concept to us, this Maya. Whereas in India people know. And Indian culture tends to be more civilized, you know. People generally they, unless of course they're very low class, but nice people in India, they're very careful to avoid events. You see this all the time. I've seen when once I was in a train station and a woman accidentally, she was turning and talking to her child or something while walking along, and she accidentally bumped into a man. And then she was so like, "Oh, I'm so very sorry." She was really humbly begging his forgiveness, that, you know, because that even accidental contact between a man and a woman that are not them, that are not related, I mean, not married, that can be misunderstood. So she wanted to make it very clear that this was an accident and didn't mean anything about it. She was very humble. Whereas in the West, women don't. Women just tend to walk on, just ignoring the fact that they bumped into someone. And men too, they're very proud. So the Western culture tends to be a lot rougher, you see. So this is our problem, not afraid of Maya. So Buddhi Yoga means to surrender the Buddhi, which is the guiding principle. Prabhupada calls it the form direction provided by the Lord. We recognize the forms of sense objects by Buddhi, and we're given direction what to do in relationship with those sense objects. You see? So when that Buddhi becomes engaged in Krishna service, when we surrender it, that instead of following my desires, using my Buddhi just to satisfy my senses, I'll now try to satisfy Krishna, then Lord Krishna has very kindly given us three stages. You begin with karma, with the work that you're used to doing, but now you do it for me. And then as jnana, this knowledge, transcendental knowledge is added, then that karma gradually, it goes from sakam. Sakam karma yoga means you've got desires to fulfill, you know. You want to have nice family life, you want to be a devotee, but you want to raise a family and this and that, you need to make money, you need all these things. So that's sakam, there's desires. But as knowledge is added, then you start to realize, what's it worth? You see, all this work just to accumulate things that are temporary anyway. So then as knowledge develops, then one becomes naturally less enthusiastic to work just to accumulate material possessions and goes more on the path of just doing one's duty. You see? And this is really what Krishna is preaching to Krishna. Krishna is speaking to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, coming to this point. Because in the beginning of Gita, Arjuna has already renounced his kaam. He can't see any reason why he should fight. There's no point. So Krishna says, so fight for me. That's the point. Do your duty. He starts with the point of doing your duty, and ultimately your duty is to me. So the more we realize this, you see, then we pass through Jnana Yoga. Jnana Yoga is the yoga of knowledge, and Krishna makes it very clear to Arjuna in 5th chapter that what is known as Samkhya Yoga is not different from Karma Yoga. That's the point he makes. You go on doing your duty, but now you're really understanding the constituents of action. You see, Samkhya Yoga means to understand what are the senses, the active senses, what are the knowledge acquiring senses, and what are their relationship with the sense objects, and what is the mind, and what is the intelligence, and finally what is the soul, and what is the super soul. To understand this hierarchy of the self very carefully, very clearly. And then Bhakti Yoga means after you become accustomed to do your duty in knowledge, you see, because the idea of this exacting knowledge is, then you won't make mistakes. Maya won't be able to trick you anymore. So once you come to that platform, then you can put your heart into it. And I'd like to give the example of, I think this is a very example everyone can relate to. It's just like learning to play a musical instrument. You know? I'm sure some of you have. I know I went through that phase when I was a boy. My mother wanted me, you know, she just considered it a part of my growing up that I should learn how to play a musical instrument. So for 2 years, I took lessons playing some instrument. And so I got to the point where I could play it, you know, play a few tunes and even enjoy it, you see. But in the beginning, I remember, I was so nervous, I was sweaty. You know, I was always worried about getting the... You just become totally concerned with the mechanics of it. And reading, you have to learn to read the music. It's a whole thing, you know. 6 months, I was just having trouble learning to read the notes and press the right key. This accordion I'm going to play. So, and then after practice, you know, after practice, you do that more naturally. You don't have to think about it so much. It becomes naturally. And then, even after more while, you start to enjoy it. You see, you're playing this nice melody, and it's happening as if you're taken over by some higher intelligence that just works through you. And that's a good musician. A good musician is just a person who can pick up almost any instrument, just play it, fool around with it a little bit, he figures it out, and then he starts playing some tune that makes everyone want to dance. You know, that's a good musician. He's just got the rasa, you know, he's just got the rasa. You know, he just goes right into the rasa of the music that this instrument can play. So I like to give that example because it shows us how this Buddha Yoga works. And why in Bhagavad Gita this term is stressed, why in renunciation through wisdom Srila Prabhupada actually uses this term so much, Buddha Yoga. And we expect it to be, why isn't he saying Bhakti Yoga? You know? And Prabhupada does say they mean the same. But Buddha Yoga specifically means in the beginning. Your buddhi, your intelligence has to learn to conform to the order of the Lord, because for so long it's been just conforming to the demands of the senses. That's where our buddhi goes, to operate the senses. And the mind, what is the mind doing? In that case, then the mind is superior to the buddhi, because the mind is tasting the fruits of the operation of the senses. The mind is the center of rasa, of taste. You see, the buddhi is just working the senses. But when the buddhi becomes in yoga with Krishna, then the buddhi is directing both mind and senses. You see, because the buddhi then is on a higher platform. The buddhi is for discrimination. You see, seeing the difference between right and wrong, not so much in a perhaps in a moralistic sense, but in a real mechanical sense. You know. This is the idea of Samkhya Yoga. You actually understand, not out of moral fear. That's there too. But actually, there's a statement where Bhaktivinoda Thakur says there's actually no place for fear in Bhakti Yoga. We should have knowledge. We should know what we're doing, so that we just do the right thing. You see? And that's what we're supposed to learn by applying buddhi. And then when one becomes accustomed to doing the right thing, not committing sinful activities, then one can become a devotee. We can put our heart into it and do it for Krishna out of love. So the buddhi needs to be trained. And then when the buddhi is in that situation, then it directs the mind. Because the mind's business is to accept and reject. The buddhi's business, it's very close, the functions. The buddhi's business is to decide. But the buddhi decides on the basis of knowledge, on the basis of you can say experience knowledge or learn knowledge. You know, just like some years ago I visited Malaysia and I used to hear, and it happens in India too, these horror stories, because we would go to these plantations where they grow rubber trees. There's many of them in Malaysia out in the forest. And there the Indian community are often found. We do did a lot of programs there. And we'd hear some sad story about just last week, a girl in one of the families died because some what's called parquat, it's a type of deadly poison that they use to kill insects, was stored in a Coca-Cola bottle and left in the shed. And this innocent girl, she's 78 years old, she's just playing around, she opens the shed door and she sees, because parquat is brown, looks just like Coca-Cola, she thinks, wow, an open bottle of Coca-Cola, and then she drinks it and dies. It's extremely deadly poison. And my visits to Malaysia, it seemed to happen all the time. Practically every plantation we went to, we'd hear some sad story. Last week, last month, some boy, some girl died, you see, because of accidentally drinking this stuff. So, what's the matter? The matter is that the kids can't read. You know, or the kids, they're just not intelligent. You see? But an adult, there'll be a little label, danger, this is poison. You see? And he just reads that and he knows by intelligent, I just shouldn't touch this. As thirsty as he might be, just imagine. You come rushing into a friend's house. He's invited you over, and you rush over, and you're very thirsty, and you have such a relationship with him that if he's not there right now, you can walk in. So you walk into his house. You're really thirsty. You've got to drink something. Really, really thirsty. So you just go to the fridge. You know, he's your friend. He doesn't mind. You open up the fridge door, and all you find in there is one bottle labeled. You see a skull and crossbones. You know. Will you drink it? No matter how thirsty you are, you're not going to drink from that. Your buddhi will step in. Your mind, you know, your senses are saying, well, something to drink. It's a bottle. The mind is saying, yeah, yeah. But then the buddhi steps in. No, forget it. It's poison. You see, it's higher knowledge. You see. So, our buddhi must become Krishnized, you know. We must set up our guiding values as Krishna directs. And then we can get out of this material world. As long as we continue to use our buddhi just to serve our senses, we'll remain in this material world. So that's the difference. Any other questions? Okay, so Nitai Gauranga Prabhu wants to would like to summarize in nice Krishna conscious fashion what he presented yesterday. We had a talk about it later.
I've changed my mind about that.
What?
I was going to do the handout, remember?
You're going to?
Do the handout. Give a handout.
Yeah. Give a handout?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do for.
Okay. Alright, whatever you want to do. I won't say anymore.
We'll skip that part.
You're going to do something, right?
Today.
Today?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thursday,
but sure. not at this instant.
No, in the next red mark.
Okay, alright. Now I understand.
If we get that far.
Okay. Never mind what I just said. We'll just proceed. And yes, and now we're going to start to get into the promised deeper and deeper and deeper entrance into the Bhagavata explanation of the mysterious workings of the mind. What the mind is and what it isn't. So, we refer you to Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 13, Verse number 8. This is in the portion of the Bhagavatam which is famously known as the Uddhava Gita. There's the Bhagavad Gita, which you all know, but there's another Gita called Uddhava Gita, which Krishna speaks to Uddhava. And one day in this school we're going to have a three-cornered class. We're going to study simultaneously Bhagavad Gita, Uddhava Gita, and the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Why are we going to study the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the conversation between Maitreya and Vidura? Because Maitreya was present when Krishna spoke the Uddhava Gita to Uddhava, and yet, when you read third canto and 11th canto, there's a lot of differences, because Maitreya is a great sage. So, it's a very interesting parallel. You see, in the Vedas you have what is called Prashtantraya. Prashtantraya means, it's like a stool on three legs. They say that a stool on three legs is much more stable than a chair on four legs. Because a chair on four legs, see, if you lean to one side, and then two legs on this side will go up, and, you know, then you're just on two legs and you'll fall over. But that won't happen because you've got on a three-legged stool, because they're facing in three different directions. It's much harder to topple from a stool with three legs. So, real Vedic knowledge is very solidly standing on three legs. They're called the Prashtantraya. So, first is Shruti. And Shruti means the direct instruction. The direct instruction, like Prabhupada said, Brahma Samhita. Our Brahma Samhita is an example of Shruti Srastra because, why? Because it comes directly from the first Acharya, who is Brahma. You see? But even above Brahma there is Krishna. So in 11th canto, Krishna, the supreme Acharya, the origin of all transcendental knowledge, is directly speaking to Uddhava. And so that is Shruti. And he's speaking on, and it's a very interesting book, it's a very interesting section of the Bhagavatam to study alongside of Bhagavad Gita, because there, if you look at the Sanskrit, there are many verses that are very similar in language. But the Uddhava Gita is much more voluminous. So it's like, it's something like Krishna's own purport to the Bhagavad Gita. Same basic topics are covered, but Krishna gives voluminous, more explanation, more details, more examples, more stories, more analogies. And finally, it makes it very, very clear what love of God means, also, in the sense of the prayojan. He hints at it in Bhagavad Gita. Sarva dharam prachidya mamikam sharanam jaya. Srila Prabhupada once agreed that this is actually, this verse can be taken to Krishna as Krishna's call to the gopis. The gopis, being women, they have their dharma to stay at home with their husbands, and Krishna's calling them out. Give that dharma up and just surrender to me. And don't fear. Don't fear. Don't be afraid. I will protect you. So, but it is only hinted at in the Gita. But in Uddhav Gita, it's all brought out. And then when you look at third canto, it is much more sagacious. It is much more Vedantic. It is much more tattvic. Because of Maitreya. Because of Maitreya, he's a sage. So in the original Prashtantraya, you have Shruti Shastra spoken, yes, by great authorities like Brahma, great, great rishis. And then you have Nyaya Prashtan, which is the explanation of that. Oh, you didn't get it? You didn't get what they said? Maybe you have trouble accepting it because it is so authoritative. Then Nyaya Prashtan, which is Vedanta Sutra. The Vedanta, that is giving arguments. You see, it is removing doubts. That's the way Vedanta Sutra works. I don't know if any of you have ever looked at it, but it begins with a statement, and then there's a doubt is presented. The statement, maybe it is, maybe it isn't, and then there's what's called Purva Paksha, someone taking advantage of the doubt, someone saying yes, it's actually wrong, and then there's refutation of that doubt. And then the truth is established through this process of argument. So this is called nyaya. Nyaya means logical argument. So that's another leg on which the Vedas stand. And then there's smriti. Smriti includes all the Puranas. In a sense, it includes Srimad Bhagavatam. It's counted as a Purana, although in Srimad Bhagavatam there's also, like Bhagavad Gita also, can be considered smriti because it falls within Bhagavad Gita. Smriti means that which is to be remembered. It's easy to remember because it's presented in history form. Purana means history. Itihasa means history. So there's stories of... It's something like law books and law journals. You know, law books give the law. And sometimes, you know, in this legal language, it's very hard to understand, you know. You need a special dictionary to understand what they're saying. But if there's a case, and this is very often brought up in courts, isn't it? A lawyer will raise a hand. Your Honor, I wish to point out that there's been a precedent to this case in 1928. The exact same situation came up in court, and the judge found the defendant not guilty because of this, and I'm arguing today that the exact same circumstances are here, and therefore my client must be let free, because precedence has already been set. So he tells the story of that case, and that is evidence. So Puranas work that way. They tell a story, they tell a history, you see. And this is very good for us Kali Yuga people, because when we just hear principles, we fall asleep. And when we hear logic, too much logic and argument, we fall asleep. When we hear a story, oh, that's exciting. Yes, yes, yes. Great. So that's why Bhagavatam is such a good scripture. Because actually it is Shruti. Actually it is Shruti. But it is presented as if it was Smriti. You see? Because who is speaking in the Bhagavatam? Krishna is speaking in the Bhagavatam. And 12 Mahajans are speaking in the Bhagavatam. 12 greatest authorities on devotional service. They appear in the pages, all 12 of them. You may ask, where's Janak? He's one of the 12. Where does he appear? He appears in the 11th canto. He's Maharaj Nimi speaking with the Navayogendras, because he's in that line, all those kings in that line, descending from the original Janak, whose father was the father of Sita. They're also known as Janak. So he is a Janak. And he's so fortunate that he's having direct a darshan of the Navayogendras, who are among the greatest mystics and the greatest authorities of spiritual knowledge in the whole creation. So all of the Mahajans appear to instruct us in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. So it is certainly Shruti, but it appears in the form of Smriti to hold our interest. You see? And Smriti is important because you see the result. There's the Shruti, the law. The law is given what you should do, what you shouldn't do. And then you see what happens if someone doesn't do. If someone breaks the law, he gets reaction, he ends up in hell, he gets punished. And if someone follows the law, ultimately it's the law of love, the law of surrendering to Krishna. He surrenders to Krishna, even if he's a demon. That's the most wonderful thing. Because this law is transcendental. This dharma, Bhagavad Dharma, is transcendental dharma. It's not material dharma. So, just like it says early on in the Gita, in the first canto, why does Krishna descend Indrari Vakyulam Lokam? He comes to kill the enemies of Indra. That's the definition of demon. Enemy of Indra is a demon. And then in canto 6, there's Vritrasura. Now who is Vritrasura? What is Vritrasura? You read this? Canto 6? And what is he? He's an enemy of Indra. He's technically a demon. But what happens at the end? Who goes back home to Godhead? Who has to stay and suffer? The demon goes back to Godhead, and Indra has to stay and suffer. So, the Jiva Goswami says, this proves that the Srimad Bhagavatam is transcendental. That proves. It's not about material dharma. This is transcendental dharma. So even a demon can be a great devotee. Someone who's technically a demon can be a great devotee, pure devotee, go back to Godhead. And a great pious personality like Indra, who has all good material qualifications, he has to stay and take birth again. You see? Because he did not surrender to the Lord. So, I don't want to lose track. We have to continue. Yes, we were talking about the Uddhava Gita. This comes from the Uddhava Gita. And so in the course of this Gita, Uddhava has a question. And the question is very important for us all. And especially in the context of what Nitya Gauranga was saying yesterday, he was giving, I thought that was a very good example. Maybe you were wondering about the context of it, but it was a very apt example of that woman who was talking about Robert Bliss, waiting for Robert Bliss to take her away, and also not, so she's attached to this person who doesn't exist, you see, and also trying to cling to her beauty. She's in her 40s, her beauty is fading away, but she's still thinking she's a beautiful young, because she was a dancer. So, Uddhava asks, generally human beings know that material life brings great future unhappiness. Yet still they try to enjoy material life. My dear Lord, how can one in knowledge act just like a dog, an ass, or a goat? And this is a very appropriate question. Sometimes we have to ask ourselves the same question. You see? Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness begins with the human form of life. Just by getting the human form of life, already there is a sense, there's a gift that comes with this human form, a gift in the sense that there's something beyond, something, Prabhupada would say, something sublime, something more than just, you see, we see these insects running around here. They have no idea that there's anything beyond gross matter. They have absolutely no inkling, because they have no brain. They have just two antennas, you know, just for feeling along the ground, feeling for things to eat or things to fear, defend themselves against. And that's how they move through life, you know, just blindly interacting with sense objects. And anything beyond that, they have no capacity to comprehend in any way, you see. And yet the evolutionists would have you believe that religion is primitive. This is another observation we could just make at this point, just a little short footnote. How ridiculous the theory of evolution is to say that religion is primitive. When, the best atheists are all in lower species, you know. If you could interview a gorilla, so, what religion do you belong to?
What's religion?
No idea. See, they don't have religion. It's only when you come to the human form of life that you start to see religion. So how can religion be something primitive? It is advanced. And so that's a special gift of the human form. And we have this sense that there's something more. So every human being has that. Every human being has a conscience, what we call a conscience. You see, a sense that there's right, that there's wrong, and it's reinforced in our upbringing. Our parents want us to act in a way that is good, that will not bring shame upon the family. And so this is drilled into us. And then society has its expectations. When you go to school, you see, you learn to act in this way and not in that way. Be a good student, don't be a ruffian. You see, be a good gentleman or a good young lady. You see. So that is natural. But unfortunately, as Uddhava is pointing out, in spite of this knowledge, human beings still act like, what does he say, dog, goat, or ass. We still become overwhelmed by the senses and make complete asses of ourselves, complete fools of ourselves. And so he wants to know why. So that's a very important question. So in the course of his answer to Uddhav, Sri Krishna recounts the question the four Kumaras asked of Brahma. This is found in verse 17 of the same chapter. In this question of the small sages of their father, the word Anyonya makes its appearance. So, let's hear the verse. Shanakadaya uchu guneshu ovishyate chito gunash chitsi cha prabhu katam anyonya samyago mumukshu atityushu. The sages said, headed by Shanaka, said, "O Lord, I want you to listen to this. Please try to focus in on this. O Lord, people's minds are generally attracted to material sense objects. And similarly, the sense objects in the form of desire enter within the mind. Therefore, how can such a person who desires liberation, who desires to cross over activities of sense gratification, destroy this mutual relationship between the sense objects and the mind? Please explain this to us." Now, is that clear? Repeat, yes. So I'll repeat in my own words. The sages observe. We can put it this way. Can you imagine a mind without any sense perceptions? If you were to take away hearing, seeing, feeling, touching, smelling, tasting, what would be left of the mind? Because the mind is called the sixth sense or the central sense, because all these other senses feed data into the mind. And the mind's business is simply on the basis of taste, rasa, to accept or reject. You see? Oh, this tastes good. This chocolate hot fudge sundae with the cherry on top. I like that. But this bowl of spinach and peanuts, I don't like that so much. You see? So this is the business of the mind. So the sages, they say that the mind is pervaded with sense impressions. And similarly, the senses are simply extensions of the mind into the material world. And yet the goal of human life is to become liberated, which means to extract the senses from their objects and enter into samadhi, you know, the first is pratyahara, to withdraw the senses from the objects. And then there's dharana, concentration, and then dhyana, deep meditation, and then finally samadhi. And that's trance. The mind enters into a trance. Nityananda Gauranga was talking about this dualistic mind, developing attachment to one thing, and at the same time in the background, the aversion to the same thing is building up, you see. And then the mind switches polarity suddenly. Suddenly that object of lust becomes an object of hatred, you see. And this is going on in the modern world between the sexes all the time. You know, this is the most obvious example. Girl meets boy, they fall in love, you know. As soon as they look into each other's eyes, the violins start playing, you know. All the sweet music, and they start talking and getting real attached. And check back 6 weeks later. They're practically strangling each other. Get out! Get out! And this is going on. So it just, what changed? Just the mind. The mind changed. That's the business. It's dualistic, chanchala, unsteady. So, the four kumars, they're actually incarnations of the Lord's jnana shakti, the shakti of knowledge. So they're interested in liberation. So they want to know how such a mind can be controlled. How can the sense objects be separated from the mind? If you separate sense objects from the mind, what do you get? Is it possible to do it? Because it seems that the mind is defined by sense objects. The mind is defined by what it sees, hears, smells, tastes, touches, and hears. And similarly, the sense objects are defined by the mind. because how could you perceive anything without the mind? You know, if you sever the optic nerves in the eyes from the brain, what will you see? You won't see anything. So does that make it more clear?
Yeah.
You see? So the question is, how can such a mind ever be controlled? How can we transcend this material world if that's the way the mind works? So here the word anyonya is translated as, quote, by Srila Prabhupada. This is not by Srila Prabhupada. This is the 11th canto, so those following in the footsteps of Srila Prabhupada. Of the mutual relationship between the sense objects and the mind. So here you have, when we talk about relationship, we have to begin about relationship, talking about relationship within ourselves, between our own mind and senses. That's the first relationship we have to examine when we want to understand psychology. Before we start talking about relationship with anybody else, we have problems relating, you know, the relationship between our own mind and senses. Huh? So, it's extremely important for us to note that this verse outlines for understanding the mechanics of material attachment. This is what this section is about, the mechanics of material attachment. So what topic is more sensitive, more provocative, more painful in the lives of devotees than this continued material attachment? You know, that's one of the offenses against the holy name. You hear instructions every day, you shouldn't be attached. And yet we chant Hare Krishna, and we realize as we're chanting, because of the thoughts that flood our mind as we chant, that I'm attached to so many things. And we chant louder and louder to try to drown it out, but the mind is, you know, sometimes very, very persistent. You know, just reminding us of this or that or the other thing. And now you're a Hare, now you've made this great mistake of becoming a Hare Krishna. And you can no longer taste A&W root beer, you see. If you're not from America, I guess you don't know what that is. You know, some very pleasurable sense object that you used to like before you were a devotee. Innocent. Nothing wrong with it. You see, but just that devotees don't do that. You never see devotees, at least I haven't lately. I haven't seen, maybe it'll come into vogue, but I haven't seen devotees walking around with lollipops in their mouths. So that's not considered proper devotional achar. So, but we may have, you know, remembrance of, well, when I was a little kid, I used to love those lemon lollies. Now I can't have them. And we're chanting Hare Krishna, 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 Krishna. I want a lemon lolly. Lemon lolly, 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 lemon, lemon, lolly, lolly, lemon. Hare lemon, Hare lemon, lolly, lolly, lolly. You see. So what this is about, this is why this section is so important, is that it is explaining the mechanics of material attachment. So, now, as soon as we bring up this word mechanics, we come to a puzzle. The puzzle of the, what is attachment, anyway? What is it? I mean, we all know what it is, in a sense. You know, we all say, well, yeah, I'm very attached to this, I'm very attached to that, or used to be attached to this, I still have some trouble sometimes, my mind is drawn to it. Like the other day someone was telling me, I'm very attached to the mountains, I'm here in Mayapur, but I want to go see the Himalayas. You see, so that was causing some conflict in his mind. So, yes, as we all know from Gita, that when we contemplate the Panchatanmatra, that means the five objects of the senses, shabda or sound, sparsha or touch, rupa or visible form, rasa or taste, and gandha or smell. The mind becomes attached to these objects. That's from Bhagavad Gita 2.62. Jayate vishyapum samsangateshu pajayate. Very famous verse. out of this relationship of the mind and the sense objects, desire makes its appearance. Sangat sanjayate kama. Kama means lust. We develop a strong desire for that which we contemplate. And again, I remind you in the introduction I said that sense object may not even be directly there. It's just something you remember. You know? Sometimes, especially when people when they reach middle age, because very often the story, at least in the Western world, the story of people's lives is boy meets girl, and somehow that relationship doesn't work out. But that was the first love. That's why Prabhupada says in real civilized societies, marriages are arranged, so that the first love is to that person you get married to. And then that love will last. But what happens in the West so much is, I remember when I was a kid, there was a song, this young love, first love, we share with true devotion. Really sentimental song.
You really date yourself there.
What is that?
You really date yourself there.
Yeah, you remember that.
5 years before my time.
Anyway, that was one of the songs I used to play on my accordion. But it somehow doesn't work out. She's sweet 16, and her family moves away to Kansas City, and we never see her again. And then we end up with, second best, a girl we meet somewhere, and well, she's okay, But then we reach age 38, 40, 45, and we're not very satisfied in this marriage, and we think back on Peggy Sue, and boy, she was so sweet. Of course, she doesn't look like that at all now, but we just have that memory in our mind, and it just brings up all this melancholy and attachment and old emotions that we thought we'd forgotten, and they all come up. That's called midlife crisis. It's a very common thing in the Western world. So I just wanted to remind you that you don't even need the direct sense objects for the mind to do this. So the question is, what's going on? What exactly is going on when the mind becomes attached to something like that? So the Kumaras are pointing out a dimension to this process that we may not have considered from our study of the Gita. It seems quite an insidious arrangement. But the fact is that the mind and the sense objects are made for each other. You see, you get this verse, Jetu Vishya Pungsat Sangat Te Shupajayati. And then we might conclude, like Nitya Gauranga Prabhu was saying yesterday, what was that? You were using this term, that enthusiasm of a brahmachari, just going to cut through that attachment.
Pure devotee syndrome.
What is that? Pure devotee syndrome. Okay, that's good. Yeah, the pure devotee syndrome. Pure devotee syndrome. I'm just going to cut through that attachment. Yeah, I know, my senses are naturally attracted to those sense objects, but I'm going to cut that with a sword of knowledge. Slash it! Just sever it! It's never going to happen again. But, sorry, it's not so easy because of this insidious arrangement that the mind and the sense objects were actually made for each other. They fit together so seamlessly that the four great sages found no way to separate them. So invaded is the mind by the sense objects, and so invaded are the sense objects by the mind, that trying to precisely tell them apart is a profound challenge to the intellect. And I tell you, that's what, I've read a lot of Western philosophy, and that's one. It's really one of the major problems, is where the mind ends and external reality begins. Where is it? And, they don't know where to put it. Because everything we're experiencing actually is through the mind. So then, you know, some people are asking the question, is everything ultimately subjective? Is it just everything just our imagination? You know, maybe there's this philosophy called solipsism. Maybe I'm the only conscious being that exists, and all of you are just my imagination. You don't exist. I've just imagined you. You're not really there. I'm crazy. I'm just talking. I'm sitting here talking to myself. You're not even there. So generally people who come to that point are, you know, locked up somewhere. So anyway, just to give you an example of what kind of problem this is. And we're not going to... Nitai Gauranga, he's going to have time tomorrow. We're going to give him the floor on this because he has a lot to say about this. But I'm going to bring us up to that point. There's just a little bit left. We have 5 minutes, we'll cover it. So consider for us a moment the smell of puris being fried in ghee. As soon as you perceive that smell, your mind becomes attached to it. This is good. But where is the good? You see? Where is it? Where does the good exist? Is the good of the smell objective? Meaning that the vapors of the fried food outside you are themselves good? Or is it subjective? Meaning that the sensation inside you, stimulated by the vapors, is good? After thinking about it a while, we're most likely... venture that the good in the smell is a result of the combination of objectivity and subjectivity. It's somewhere in between. Fine. Alright. For argument's sake, let's accept that. So, but then the next question becomes, is the good of the smell real? You see? Does that make it real? Even though you give that, yeah, there is something good out there, and because I smell it, therefore I have the experience. But does that make it real? So we as devotees, now certainly as devotees, I think, we'd all say, yes, of course. Of course when puris are fried up, that smell, of course it's a good smell. But, the reason that we'll give is that it's confirmed by our collective experience. We as devotees, we as, you know, this group of people, you know, we all agree. You know, no one here is going to say, oh God, I hate that smell. No, we all like puris. But, now I have to tell you a little story. When Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's disciples were frying up feast preparations for a Hare Krishna festival in Burma, that's the next country east beyond Bangladesh, there's east of India, just 3 hours away, is Bangladesh, which is really Bengal still. But because of British politics at the time they let India go free, India was divided into Hindustan and Pakistan, and then there was a war between East Pakistan and West Pakistan, and now East Pakistan is called Bangladesh. So they speak Bengali, just like the Bengalis here, but the Muslim population there is much greater than the Hindu. Here the Hindus are in majority, there the Muslims are in majority. That's a basic difference. And then beyond Bangladesh, go further east, you come to a land called Burma, which is a Buddhist country. So that's the beginning of what we know as Southeast Asia, you see. That's where the people start to... Already you can see, if you notice, you look at Bengalis, you know, you go to Calcutta especially, many Bengalis have kind of a... They look like Indians, but there's sort of a little bit of an oriental touch, you know? There's a little bit to the eyes, a little bit of sharpness, the face a little bit round. You notice that? So when you get... By the time you get to Burma, it's very pronounced, you know? They're looking... They're still dark, more or less, the skin color is like that of Indians still, but the face is very oriental. And then the more you go east, it just becomes more and more until you finally come to Vietnam, China, those places. And there you have the classical oriental of yellow skin hue, Japan. So Burma is an oriental country. So the local people, when this feast was being fried up, they complained about the horrible stench. All the neighbors were complaining. They came, what is this? What is this bad smell?